You have entered the realm of critical analysis, critical strangeness, critical mass, and cretinous humor. Fasten your convictions. They're in for a bumpy ride.
Hello and welcome to the Polyschismatic Reprobates Hour. Here with a face for radio and a voice for silent film, I'm Dan the Demented. Opposite me is nobody today. My lovely, adorable, and devastatingly intelligent co-host Deviant Deb is out buying a house this week. So I'm here today with Richard Carrier. He's in the studio to talk to us about how we know what we know, and his version of the basic philosophy of metaphysical naturalism, epistemology, and ethics. My interview with Richard went a little long, so this interview has been broken up into two separate podcasts, and Deb joins me at the end of the second one, which will air next week. But covering this kind of a vast territory, by the time we're done, if your brain isn't completely fried, you're likely to need some Thorazine. Richard Carrier is the author of Sense and Goodness Without God, which is you describe it as kind of a personal manifesto philosophy type of book?
Yeah. It's a worldview, a pocket worldview. You can just get the whole gamut of a particular philosophy from every branch, which is something that's much lacking in the world today. We don't have philosophers defending whole coherent systems.
Right. They just defend pet theories of...
Yeah, little isolated theories here and there, but they don't figure out how those things connect to all the other things, like philosophy of politics, for example, or aesthetics even. Where does aesthetics figure in? And that kind of thing. And how epistemology ties into metaphysics and all of that, and how ethics fits into the whole picture, too. I mean, a lot of philosophers argue about ethics just in isolation from, well, hold on, what is your epistemology of morality? What is your metaphysics, underlying metaphysics? Because that sets the basis for what sort of moral facts you think could be possible. So it's all interrelated, and so you can't really just stop, you can't just be a moral philosopher. You have to really be a complete worldview theorist, and my book does that. It presents one complete worldview, that so you can look at it and criticize the whole worldview, or adopt it, or modify it, or whatever.
In articles and debates online and in person, I've heard you refer to your particular formulation of your worldview as carrier naturalism, as opposed to a classic metaphysical naturalism. What are some of the main salient differences between carrier naturalism and metaphysical naturalism? Broader.
Well, there isn't a metaphysical naturalism. There's metaphysical naturalisms. Every philosopher has his own kind of take on it. Most metaphysical naturalists have not thoroughly thought out a complete worldview, so that it's difficult to even pin down what it is that they hold on certain subjects. But in general, I'd say where I differ from other metaphysical naturalists, at least the ones who don't agree with me, is the term I would use is non-eliminativist physicalism, which is such a difficult thing to say as a case in point. Yeah. But I'm a physicalist, but I'm not in the camp of the Churchillians, for example, that argue that because physicalism is true, folk concepts of belief and so forth are not true, and therefore we should even do without belief. We should argue that beliefs don't even exist. These other things exist that serve some other function, neurological function for belief. I don't buy into that at all. I think that there are emergent properties, even though they are reducible as a system to physical things, so that all there really are the physical things in relationship to each other, but it's the organization of those physical things that really defines what it is. It's not the substance it's made out of.
Right. A classic example would be the wetness of water. When neither hydrogen or oxygen are wet, you combine them in a certain ratio.
Right, exactly. And all there really are is hydrogen and oxygen atoms in there. I mean, there's nothing added to it. It's not like you get hydrogen and oxygen atoms and put them together and suddenly this new material appears out of nowhere. It's all has to do with the properties of those physical entities and how they're organized. And so I don't believe in eliminating belief. I don't believe in eliminating ethics, for example. So I'm a physicalist, but I don't eliminate things. And they call that eliminativism, and there's different varieties of it, but they eliminate common concepts. And a lot of physicalists have been trending in that direction, and I don't. I actually resist
and
that.
And the classic Christian apologetic objection to eliminativism is that it leads straight to nihilism.
Yeah, truly, or even just they just argue that it's absurd. I mean, you could say, talk to a layman and say, yeah, these guys don't even believe that beliefs exist. I mean, that's absurd, right? So that's that oversimplifies and sort of strawmans right. their argument. But nevertheless, I think that there's actually a genuine argument there that they're missing the boat in a sense. They're missing something. If they think that we can go around without using the word belief, they're clearly off their rocker, and they you know they're just not connecting with what the word belief actually means in practice. Right. And that's I make a big deal out of
that. They're getting hung up on the lexical and not.
Yeah, exactly, and not thinking about what the plain English means, and they're also getting confused between what people say the word means and what it actually means in practice. Right. And I think we need to get back to what the word actually means in practice, and not bother with what people claim, because people are often wrong about what they themselves mean when they say certain things. Free will is one of the common areas there, where people say they believe in a particular kind of free will, but in practice they don't. They right. behave when they talk about free will, they actually behave very differently.
Right.
So that's another example where I don't believe in eliminating free will. I believe in redefining free will in a way that actually makes sense and correlates to the way people actually behave when they talk about it.
For example, how do you do that? There's the classic libertarian position, which is an idealistic, almost
right.
Aristotelian position on free will.
Yeah, although Aristotle was hard to pin down on that. I mean, really, the real forebear to libertarian free will is mm-hmm. the Epicureans. Because the Epicureans okay. advanced, I mean, they're the ones who very clearly formulated the issue that determinism is a problem, we don't like it, therefore there's these random swerve in the atoms, and that's where free will comes from. And they very much argue against causation of the will. I think that's completely illogical. My book explains right. why. And so I take the compatibilist position, which is that what people really mean in practice by the word free will is what we actually have, and it doesn't contradict determinism at all.
Right. We just experience a free choice, even though there are causes and effects.
Right, and even what we call a free choice, what we mean by that is usually being not coerced, for
right.
example.
As opposed to just being able to choose capriciously among anything.
Yeah, right. Or say, for example, that the libertarian free willers will say that we're not even governed by our desires. Even our desires don't cause our choice.
Right.
We're like we're independent even of desires, which mm-hmm. makes no sense whatsoever, because what you do, you always do what you most desire, by definition.
Right.
And I don't even understand why they would want a world where desires don't cause our actions. I mean, if you want to do something, why would you want a system in your brain that would cause you to do something you didn't want? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So,
is it bleed over from the Buddhist notion that desires are an enslaving force?
Well, I don't think it's connected to Buddhism, but okay. you're partly right. It has a lot to do. Well, actually, you know, really, the main reason libertarian free will is so popular, actually, it's not terribly popular among philosophers who discuss the issue. Most are compatibilists, but most of the ones who defend libertarian free will are Christians, and they defend it because they have to.
Right, because if there isn't a libertarian free will, the
God is at fault for everything.
God is at
exactly,
fault for everything.
Exactly, right. So the only way that they can defend the morality of God is to defend the libertarian concept of free will, mm-hmm. no matter how absurd that is. And that's the main
reason. And defending
that
in light of original sin, which is the other doctrine they have to hold to, which holds that there's a compulsion to do evil, even when you don't want to.
Yeah, but your free will can overcome that. That's their thought. But of course,
it doesn't work very well.
There's serious gaps in the theory. Let's put it that way. But what I would say is that the non-Christians who defend libertarian free will, mm-hmm. that's bleed over from the Christians. So the Christians are making these arguments in favor of libertarian free will. Some of these people, other people, are being convinced by these arguments mm-hmm. and therefore taking up the cause. But
I think
it's driven by this Christian need to defend
right.
God.
Do you think there's also something just by virtue of being in America, which is a country built on the ideal notion of self-determination, it's a mythic fit, even if it doesn't actually make sense?
Yeah, I would be very interested in seeing a demonstration of that, because that seems very plausible to me. Because it does seem that libertarian free will defenders are predominantly in capitalist societies, predominantly in frontier societies like the United States. So there may be a social aspect or a sociological aspect to it. But again, that would be the result of a sort of linguistic superstition, a sort of fallacious leap of logic
right.
from self-determination to libertarian free will. There really isn't
right.
a connection between them. But this is one thing that I discuss much more length in my book. So people, I'm sure, like, have lots of audience members.
Yeah,
lots of audience members would be, you know, want to argue against it. Yeah. But if you want to argue against it, read the chapter first. Another area where I differ from other metaphysical naturalists is in my epistemology, where I'm kind of in the middle between Quine and the positivists. I don't accept a lot of Quine's arguments against logical positivism. Mm-hmm. But I also don't accept, I don't think the logical positivists were correct to eliminate metaphysics.
Right. Now, I'm a little bit rusty on this.
Yeah.
I haven't studied positivism since college.
Right.
So
yeah.
If I remember right, and I probably don't, positivism basically asserts that if you can't prove it, it doesn't exist.
It's a little more technical than that.
Okay.
The definitive book to read, really, is A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic, and the second edition, in fact, because the second edition actually revised it to respond to Quine, although he doesn't mention Quine, I don't think. And in effect, I think he effectively refuted Quine, although everybody thinks that Quine refuted logical positivism, and they think Quine killed it. But he didn't, really. His arguments were actually fallacious. But positivists made the mistake. If you read Language, Truth, and Logic, Ayer is right about pretty much everything in the book except when he starts talking about ethics and metaphysics. Because I think he misunderstands what metaphysics is. And when he talks about metaphysics, he means first philosophy. He means sitting in an armchair and reasoning out the features of the world just through logic.
Right.
That's one way of doing metaphysics. But that's not the fundamental issue of what metaphysics is today, which is taking our knowledge of physics and basically extrapolating, well, what then fills out the rest of the furniture of the universe? What is probably the case, given what we know so far?
Right.
So in a sense, metaphysics synthesizes scientific knowledge to come up with a complete worldview. And that, of course, is completely in line with positivistic principles, because when you say something about a metaphysical fact, you are issuing a hypothesis that one day, theoretically, could be tested. So it's not a situation where it's an untestable a priori.
So positivism is much more of a strict foundationalism with a heavy linguistic
emphasis.
It is.
And they went a little too far. For example, they would argue that theoretical entities, like, for example, atoms. Atoms, we don't know really whether atoms exist. The model of the atom is just a theoretical model. All
right.
We know are the phenomena. And since the model works, we go with it.
Right.
But we don't know any more than that. I think there are certain things that we can infer about what is and is not the case in the construction of an atom.
So
we might not know every single aspect of it, but
right.
we there are certainly things you can say that are not going on in the atom, and there are certain things you can say that are going on in the atom. So we do have knowledge of things we can't see directly. And I think and that's that I adopt right. that view, which is sort of really the modern philosophy of science now is very much takes that view.
Yeah.
But I don't think that view actually contradicts the basic principles of positivism. And I think it was the positivists who went too far in inferring that we should get rid of all this stuff, when in reality that stuff is perfectly in line with their basic principles.
The way you're describing at least modern positivism, it sounds also a lot like a response to Kant.
I don't know.
Is it not directly related?
I have not studied Kant's epistemology enough to comment on that aspect of it. But for example, one of the fundamental principles of positivism is that a proposition means what it predicts, essentially. I'm oversimplifying, but it's essentially whatever the predictions that would verify or falsify that proposition are already inherent in the meaning of the words and the way they're arranged.
Okay.
And very
much like the way the scientific method works now.
I would say so, yes. And in fact, positivism grew out of an attempt to rationalize scientific method and improve it.
Oh, okay.
So it comes very much from physicists, mainly, and philosophers who were very impressed by the success of basic physics in the 19th century and early 20th century. Anyway, so I reject the positivist principle that there is no metaphysics. I think we can expand, and I think we can say factual things about morals. I think there are moral facts, for example. And I think, but I think that the belief that logical positivism was refuted is also wrong, and I think we need to pay more attention to their analysis of the meaning of language and the importance of the meaning of language towards understanding truth statements
right.
and so forth. So I think that's a situation where I think they threw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
I think we need to go back to positivism and sort of go back to where the positivists went wrong and then start back again, but going in the right direction. I think that's what needs to be done.
Right.
And that's where I differ a lot from a lot of other metaphysical naturalists who simply assume that positivism is dead and pretty much don't pay much attention to it. Like, as in your case, you hadn't even studied it since college, right? It's not being taken seriously, and I
Though
think it needs to be taken
level,
seriously.
On a practical level, that's very much how I operate. So
yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to have to go back and read that.
Right.
Now, so then would Foucault and the rise of the literary postmodernists be a reaction against the positivists?
Absolutely, yes, very much. In fact, you could also say, in a sense, that positivism and that sort of strand of postmodern thinking are sort of responses to the same phenomenon, the same sort of discovery of limits and gaps in our knowledge and how the meaning of words and so forth affects what we believe and so on. Although these aren't really new ideas. I mean, it goes all the way back to, you read Sextus Empiricus, you know, 2nd century AD, 3rd century AD. These skeptics were already talking about the same things that the postmoderns are talking about. But that doesn't prevent... And see, the postmodernists, they also go too far. They say that, well, yes, knowledge is socially constructed, but they take the next leap and say, well, that's all knowledge is social construct.
Right,
and
then you have the elimination of meaning.
Yeah, it's all it is words and what you believe. There's you know, you can't even get to the truth. But that's not correct either. And of course, you could cite countless examples. I mean, we couldn't have gotten to the moon had that not had there not actually been a rocket that could actually go to the moon.
It's not simply a remarkable coincidence that our senses provide us with data that allow us to manipulate the world.
Yes, we didn't just believe our way to the moon. Let's put it that way. Yeah, we didn't socially construct our mission to the moon. That kind of thing where I think the postmodernists go too far.
Right.
And in a sense, that's the stand I take there. And then finally, and I think one thing that we'll get to later is on ethics. I actually believe there are moral facts. And so my moral philosophy is a form of objective realism. A lot of metaphysical naturalists aren't on board with this yet. There still seems to be an overpopularity of relativism and subjectivism, and attempts to rationalize and make those systems make sense, which I think is going in the wrong direction. And I think we actually can make positive, true statements about what is morally right and wrong. And that divorces me, not from all metaphysical naturalists, but from many of them.
And the rise of subjectivism and relativism in ethics, is that mostly an outgrowth of the social sciences, the rise of cultural anthropology?
I don't know as to an outgrowth. The whole growth of anthropology as a scientific field, and sociology as well, has definitely affected the argument and made relativism and subjectivism more popular and more defensible in that respect. And this is another case where they're partly right, but they just go too far. I mean, it is true that a lot of moral beliefs are relativistic. A lot of moral beliefs are subjective, and they may even have a subjective foundation. But that's not the end of the story. You don't stop there. You keep looking and saying, well, how, for example, would I argue with someone in another culture that they shouldn't do something? If you take that scenario seriously and think it through, how would you successfully persuade them? You'll eventually see that there are
common biological basis and work up.
And common aspects of the environment, you know, for example, food. Everybody needs food. That's the simplest thing. That's not a cultural thing. You can't have a culture that just, you know, decides by convention that we don't need to eat.
Yeah.
But also the environment affects issues of food too. It's not just our biology. It's if you want to grow corn, there's a certain way to grow corn based on the nature of physics, based on the nature of the earth, based on the nature of the climate. Anyway, and we share all of these things. And I think, because this is talking about mere practical issues, but when you think in the same way about morality, you end up finding that there are issues of common ground and that you could persuade someone in another culture to adopt your moral values simply by appealing to values they already have. And that, I think, indicates that there is an objective moral system that can be constructed that's based on what it is that would actually be best for everyone, in a sense.
So it becomes an issue rather than of social construction from the ground up, of contextualization of biological and physical facts into certain circumstances, and building ethics off of the basic moral facts that arise from that common ground.
Exactly, and I think it also starts, there's certain core values that everyone shares, and then from those you can demonstrate, based on certain physical facts and those core values, that you should also adopt certain other values. And so these derivative values. Well, compassion and honesty are my two fundamental virtues that I describe in my book. And compassion, I mean, compassion is not a universal value in and of itself, because there are people who don't think they need to value, you know, the feelings of other people. But you can go to someone and point out all the things that suck in their life, like how lonely they are, how disappointed they are, how constantly paranoid they are. They're all constantly angry and disappointed with life. And you can say, you know, the reason your life sucks so much is that you don't have enough love in your life. You don't have enough real friendship. You don't have good social interaction with other people. And you don't even have the basic joys of vicariously feeling good with someone. You know, if there's people experiencing joy around you,
it's
and
contagious.
You're open to that, yeah, exactly, you're enjoying that as well. And so it actually is better for you to spread more joy than to spread misery, you know.
Right.
In many different ways. I mean, those are just some of the ways in which it impacts you. And so you can appeal to this basic simple fact that you want to be happy. This person wants to be happy, not miserable. Mm-hmm. That's a universal value. And from that, you can say, well, you know, if you want to be happy, it's just as a matter of actual fact, you're going to have to cultivate compassion and honesty, a compassionate and honest character. And that will basically start aligning things in your life so that things will start getting better.
Right. Now, how does this work when you're dealing with someone who's in a culture that is entirely, or at least mostly, devoted to social climbing and sees compassion as a weakness?
Right. Well, in that situation, you would analyze exactly, first of all, whether their culture is working for the people who are in it. That's one thing. I mean, if it's a situation where you have the elites basically crushing on you know, the masses and essentially exploiting them, the argument then is, you guys, the masses, need to rise up and get rid of these guys because they're just exploiting you. And that, of course, is what happens throughout history, is when the masses start realizing that they're suckers, rocks start to fly, you know, and that's the situation where, and that, of course, creates social chaos, and that's not good for anybody. Mm-hmm. So it's better to even start at the beginning with a social system where there isn't exploitation. Now, of course, that's just an ideal, but you need to work in that direction. And I think, finally, that I'll just add that I think I'm one of the few metaphysical naturalists who actually talks about aesthetic philosophy anymore.
I've noticed a really surprising dearth of that.
It's almost as if, it's just beauty's in the eye of the beholder, end of story. Right. No, that's not the end of the story. even if that were the end of the story, there's a lot more to talk about there.
There's a basic reason that everyone still looks on the old masters as the old master.
Right, exactly. And also, I mean, even if it were the case that it was just random, let's say everybody's particular aesthetic tastes were just random or culture produced or whatever, there's still a lot of philosophical analysis that needs to be going on there. It's like, why do certain people acquire certain aesthetic tastes? Is that good for them? Is it bad for them?
So what does it say about the personality and the culture that is coming out of what's it expressing?
Exactly. There's so much philosophy that could be written about on aesthetic theory, and I think metaphysical naturalists, by and large, are neglecting this field. And then
now,
finally,
why are they neglecting the field?
I don't know. This isn't one area where I have looked and debated the issue with other metaphysical naturalists to see. Fellow naturalists, I haven't gone up and asked them, why aren't you reading or writing more about aesthetic philosophy? So that's something I don't know yet.
It really is a striking difference between, say, H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell and that generation of naturalist philosophers and our current generation.
That's true. I would say
the Victorians, for as fucked up as they were, they did have an understanding of how important beauty was.
Yes, and I would say probably the last metaphysical naturalist to write seriously on aesthetic theory was, strangely enough, Ayn Rand.
Really?
I would definitely classify her as a metaphysical naturalist.
Yeah,
her system
falls
in that category
system.
In the same way that Marxist philosophy does. And so you have on two extremes. You have the Marxist, extreme liberal socialist metaphysical naturalism. Mm-hmm. Objectivism is the extreme libertarian. Of course, the objectivists hate being called libertarians, but extreme capitalistic version of metaphysical naturalism. They're both metaphysical naturalist philosophies.
And neither one actually works without... It's impossible to understand either.
There's serious problems. Yeah.
Or Marxism without understanding how they arose in opposition to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're both very much in practice unlivable philosophies, at least on a social level. Although I'm sure many of your listeners will be outraged at that. But
I'm sure they will. We've got plenty of both of them.
Yeah. We could do a whole show on what I think is wrong with Ayn Rand's philosophy. But nevertheless, she was right about a lot of things. And her aesthetic theory is very close to mine. I think, in fact, influenced mine. I think her aesthetic theory is very close to what is correct, in my opinion. I think it was a little simplified and a little naive, maybe, but nevertheless, she was on the right track, in a sense.
Could you expand your aesthetic theory a little bit?
First I'll just start with her simplified version of her theory. Okay. Now, her theory was that the purpose of art and beauty was to convey heroic values, in a sense. And so, basically, any work of art should serve the purpose of instilling and communicating what is good and what is bad, in a sense. So heroes and villains would represent what your philosophy says are genuinely heroes and villains. So and all art should somehow be focused in that direction. And for example, even something as simple as oil paintings, she was in favor of the classical realism because it celebrates nature, it celebrates reality, in a sense, as opposed to abstract art, which does not, and it almost seems like a retreat from reality. And that very much embodies the values of her philosophy. So if to her, classical realism is more, and it celebrates human genius, human discipline, and so on. And so mm-hmm. that just the art itself represents the values of her philosophy.
Right.
And she thought that's what art should do. And I think she's right in that sense, mm-hmm. that really is the best function. There are other functions of art, and I discuss them in my book. And there's also, we now have a scientific, physiological understanding more so of art than we ever had before, certainly mm-hmm. in her day. And so I incorporate all of that. But the basic gist of it is very similar to that, where art should communicate things that are good for humanity or that are meaningful, and that art can be used to convey meaning in that sense.
Now, what on the subject of abstracts, I'm very much a Renaissance fan. I love classical realism. But...
Yeah, so do I.
There's this thing that abstracts do, if they're not just swirls of paint on a canvas with absolutely no meaning. There's almost a meditative value that some of them have. Particularly the borderline abstract surrealism and cubism and things like that that are all suggestion with no content. Where does that fall in your aesthetic philosophy?
I don't have much respect for it. I mean, to an extent, I mean, you take like Dada, for example. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're including him in that category.
I don't know Dada, actually.
Very abstract. It's sort of, I think it's called abstract realism, but it's very realistic but bizarre alternate reality kind of stuff. That at least exhibits a certain amount of discipline. I mean, and knowledge and skill and so forth. And so there's still certain values being conveyed there that I approve of. Whereas the sort of abstract art where you just take a piece of metal and you twist it in a funky shape and say, oh, this is art, you know, paint it all red. Wow, isn't that great? I think that has very little aesthetic value.
Hey, I was thinking more the kind of middle ground, the little farther out bits of Dali and Picasso.
Yeah. You know, I haven't studied Picasso enough to really comment. I mean, I can say for one thing, I wouldn't have a Picasso hung in my house because I don't find it attractive at all, and I don't even understand what it is that it communicates that's of value, really. Even in terms of moods, I mean, you know,
I've always seen it very much as mood type of painting.
Yeah, and I don't entirely understand how people get certain moods from Picasso, and that may just be a limitation in me. I haven't studied you know, the artistic style enough and so forth.
And I'm sure some of it, and not to be facetious because this is going to sound this way, but some of the appeal of abstract, I'm sure, has to do with being good acid trip material.
In practice, most of the artists that I see doing this sort of thing are straight laced, you know, granola eating, you know, people that wouldn't drop acid for their life, you know, you know what I mean?
Yep.
You know, people that are dropping acid are actually producing very interesting stuff. You know, goth art, for example, is, you know, this is the drug culture, is producing very interesting artwork that's certainly nothing like abstract. I mean, it might be abstract in the sense that it's bizarre, but
the drug culture art, even in the last 100 years, there's the jazz revolution, the blues revolution, rock and roll.
Oh, good point, bringing up music. Yes, that's another example if you want to go like abstract music would be, you know, more in the direction of, I can't think of the guy's name right now. Philip Glass, I guess, would be in classical or in orchestral music. But it's just monotonous not as interesting. I mean, if you look at the operas today is cinema. So if you want to look at if you want to find the Mozarts and the Beethovens, you look at film score producers. It's not like these Philip Glass guys that just sort of produce their little intellectual vanities, you know, in local local orchestras. It's cinema. And so if you look, for example, I'll just take an example of, I think, what is my favorite soundtrack of all time is the Firefly series. I don't know if you're familiar with
that. Oh, that was beautiful, that soundtrack.
Yes, that soundtrack, I mean, for the series, they made this on a disc. You can buy it on Amazon of all the music from most of the music from the series. If you listen to that, it far excels most blockbuster movie
soundtracks. Does.
And that is, it's just a masterpiece. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. It's creative.
And it's spare, which is something that isn't very popular now.
Exactly, without being monotonous like a Philip Glass piece. Yeah, exactly. And so I think that really, and in many ways, I listened to, for example, the commentary track of the composer, I can't think of his name just now, where he talks about how he was using music to convey certain feelings and moods and values and so forth. And And he was spot on. I mean, I really got it, even without having heard him say those things. And so that I think, is a masterpiece.
And he also, watching the series, even before they ever land on a planet, you know all you need to know about the culture by the way he blends Japanese with Chinese.
Yeah,
with
exactly,
old West,
country,
with, you know, all the different styles he blends together seamlessly.
Right, and it's a seamlessly, and when it's discordant, it's meant to be discordant.
Right,
and
it's not just, oh, I couldn't figure out what to put down.
Exactly,
here.
There's discipline involved, there's skill involved, there's creative insight involved, and those are all things that are of some of the greatest things about humanity. So just the fact that he's engaging the discipline and making the effort and succeeding at bringing out these realities and communicating these values through his music is in itself a celebration of what's great about humanity. Whereas someone who just makes shit up, you know, well, that might be very clever or creative, but it's not a celebration of what's great about man.
Right. It's, and a lot of abstract art in both music and painting and sculpture does tend to strike me as if it's a rough draft.
Yeah, right. Well, there's a line in I don't know if you ever watched this British TV show called Absolutely Fabulous.
I haven't seen much of it.
Oh, it's pretty funny, but there's one of the characters in it. They're both despicable characters, but one of them makes a statement that's so entirely true, and she says, you know, what's the difference between an artist who chooses to paint like a child and a child's painting? You know?
I love it.
You know, and she's like, yeah, you know, what really? And exactly. It's like, yes, because the child lacks the skill and knowledge and discipline to actually produce a great work of art. Mm-hmm. So if you choose to lack the discipline or apply the discipline and skill.
Right.
I mean, I knew one abstract artist and asked her, I said, you know, could you produce something like, you know, a realist painting or something like an Alma Tadema or something like that. And she's like, oh yeah, but why would I? And I had a difficult time believing that she actually had spent the time to develop the skills and knowledge, for example, knowledge of anatomy that's necessary to correctly paint
to
the human form.
With all that time.
Yeah. And not right. Yeah. I doubt she really could have done it. You know, and even if she could have, it would have been bizarre to have learned all of that and acquired such admiration for example, human anatomy.
Right.
And then abandon it. Yeah.
Right.
And even if you did, that to me would be a retreat from one's humanity. It would be sort of a denigration of what is great about
it. They don't pay enough money for the abstract.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one ever would.
Yeah. So anyway, aesthetic philosophy, I take seriously and incorporate into my worldview. And I have a chapter on it in my book. And finally, is politics. A lot of metaphysical naturalists. Well, we've talked already about Marxists and objectivists, two extremes there.
Right.
And where I differ, I think a lot of metaphysical naturalists are left-leaning. There are some right-leaning ones, but predominantly, though, I think I differ from many metaphysical naturalists in being more moderate. My position is that I don't think that there should be liberal philosophy or Republican philosophy or conservative politics or liberal politics. There should just be sound politics. And I think I elaborate certain principles
of
moderation.
The notion of a political science actually has lexical connotation for you.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, political science is one thing. I mean, political science actually studies law-like interactions and political actions that actually have they study cause and effect in the real world and try to come up with, if you do certain things, these certain things will result.
Right.
And of course, this present administration ignores that entirely. But a political scientist who really knew his stuff would tell you even right off the bat that you can't just walk into Iraq and set up a democracy. And he would explain there's certain things that have to be causally in place for that to happen, and they're not in place, and you're not going to be able to put them in place with any amount of money.
Right.
And
need a lot of time.
Yeah, yeah.
Among
other people
things.
Talk about infrastructure, but you need an ideological infrastructure.
Yes, absolutely.
Very much.
And the fact that before the Ba'athist rise, the Iraqis were getting there. You know, it's been over a generation since then. You've lost a lot of ground. You can't.
It's
just
true.
Jump right back
well, and
it.
A lot of that isn't. It's not just the Ba'athist resistance, which might even be a fiction. I mean, it has a lot to do with the fact that all the enemies of Iraq have seen the perfect opportunity to slip troops in
and
through all
the
borders. So but basically most of the fighting that's going on in Iraq are actually enemies of Iraq who are trying to destroy the country.
Reasons,
and
No, I meant before the Baathist rose in the 70s, they were moving towards a sort of
It's true. And we didn't help, but that's another that's another story.
Yeah, there's a lot of Cold War politics that were so short-sighted.
That's true. Well, anyway, political science is about cause and effect. It's more of an actual science in that sense. Not quite as definitive as physics, for example. But political philosophy goes a step back and says, okay, well, now we know what causes what. What should we do? I mean, that's what political philosophy is about. Once what you do with the facts about political science once you've gathered them. And yes, I do take that very seriously. And I think it is... not many metaphysical naturalists I know of write on political philosophy, but there is a lot of political philosophy being written by people who may be metaphysical naturalists without identifying themselves as such.
I think you're right. There's a basic notion that a classically liberal philosophical orientation towards metaphysical naturalism, classical foundationalism, reverence for the scientific method and all that sort of stuff, that kind of liberal implies what is colloquially liberal, which really isn't. It seems to me that the left and the right both make essential errors building their philosophy by judging human nature to be something they wish it was rather than what it is.
That's a good observation. In fact, I could probably expand on that. In my book, I identify essentially the extreme liberal and conservative views I identify as actually being the product of the same psychology. It's the same mindset of black and white thinking.
Yeah.
They just get pushed in different directions, essentially.
They start with different people that they like more.
or different life experiences, for example. You know, where you're raised has a lot to do with it. Happens to you as a child has a lot to do with it.
And where you see the essential wellspring of human evil, whether it's greed or self-aggrandizement or organizations as opposed to individuals or what have you.
Yeah, that's one thing I point out in my book is there's a big difference in conservative versus liberal versus how they treat individual liberty versus institutional liberty.
Yeah.
In fact, they're the exact flip side of each other on that issue and once again go too far in either direction, both of them. So political philosophy is another one. And the fact that I come down more in a moderate position also distinguishes my worldview. And I think also the fact that I take aesthetics and ethics and politics, these three branches of philosophy, and build them from the foundation of epistemology and metaphysics that forms the whole worldview, so that unlike other political philosophers and other moral philosophers who are just sort of arguing in isolation from any systematic worldview, or at least any clear attempt to do so, mine is based and therefore constrained to fit, in a sense. So I'm making sure, and using that as a measure, for example. Political philosophy, if it doesn't make sense with what my epistemological and metaphysical beliefs are, then I've got it wrong. And so I need to re-examine and reorganize.
And figure out whether it's the foundational stuff or the...
Exactly. So when you're thinking in these terms, you produce a coherent worldview, I think you're more likely to end up with correct conclusions on all the branches of philosophy than if you pursue one of them individually.
Now, in pursuing one individually, or at least only talking publicly about one individually, is that a basic lack of, for lack of a better word, holistic thinking, or is that a shadow game, or does it really depend on who you're talking about?
As a philosopher and an academic, I can't say for sure. However, I can just pontificate on my own personal opinions, whether they're true or not. I have certain opinions about what I think is going on in philosophy as a field. One of the things is that philosophy as an academic field is trying to be science. They're using specialized language, they're getting hyper-specific, they're specializing in the way that scientists specialize. And they're trying more and more to look like science, but they're not science. Philosophy is not science. Philosophy relies on science. Philosophy can adopt some of the methods of science, but philosophy has to be holistic. It has to be worldview oriented. I mean, and it should use or rely more on plain language, and not try to jargonize. Sometimes you have to jargonize to a certain extent to make precise distinctions, but you shouldn't jargonize simply for the sake of sounding impressive.
Right.
And I think a lot of the problems in philosophy come from jargonizing, where a label will get smacked on something, and then as soon as you say something that sounds similar,
they immediately peg you
there, and they assume you come with all that other baggage. And I see this going on again and again and again in philosophy, which is a big problem. So I think there's this sort of trend to try and make philosophy seem more like science, I guess. And I think philosophers have really, and you look at the journals, for example, what's getting published. Most of the philosophy that I see getting published today is useless, of no interest to the average man. I mean, it's hyper-technical discussions on often useless minutiae. Mm-hmm. That if you went back to Aristotle or Socrates or Seneca or even Sextus Empiricus or Ptolemy or Galen, who both wrote on philosophy, a lot of people don't know that they did. If you were to bring this stuff back to them and go, what the hell are you wasting your time on that stuff for? You know, and they all believed very much that your philosophy has to be coherent and has to be systematic and has to all right. The fields have to cohere together, or else you're just wasting time. You're just, you know, spinning your wheels in a mm-hmm. sense. And I think, I don't know why, but I think philosophers as a whole academic field have lost a sense of who they are and what their function is in society. I mean, the purpose of philosophy should be to benefit mankind. Mm-hmm. It should be to make sense of our world.
It seems to have fallen apart that way in the late 19th and early 20th century, or at least started to.
It may
what,
be.
What was it that happened? Was it the collapse of the Western Empire system?
You know, I really don't know. I don't know. I mean, I would have to talk to a historian of intellectual history, of American intellectual history, for example, might have a meaningful answer to that question.
Okay.
I don't know enough about it to say why that's happened, but I have observed it to happen. I mean, philosophy today, I mean, they're not talking about systems. And I think the last great system of philosophy was logical positivism. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was, they were already chucking branches mm-hmm. of philosophy overboard, you know, in right. a sense, and wrongly, incorrectly.
Right. And since then, some of the best the best philosophy that's come close to being systemic are from people that are essentially literary critics, not the postmodernists,
right.
but people
outside
like,
the,
people
the...
like Orwell, people like Nietzsche, who was kind of a philosopher, but was much more of a literary critic.
Yeah, yeah.
With the exception, really, of Russell, who had more of a coherent...
Well, and of course, Russell, that's predating the demise, so to speak, of logical
right.
positivism. I mean, Russell would be one of the last philosophers, one of, mm-hmm. not the, but one of the last philosophers to really systematize. Ayn Rand, mm-hmm. it's hard to really peg her as a philosopher because she didn't interact at all with
right.
contemporary
she was
philosophers.
Much more of a literary. To a lesser extent, Heinlein did the same sort of thing, but... Like Ayn Rand, he was a literary person.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't peg Ayn Rand as a literary critic. She was a philosopher in the sense that she did all the things that philosophers
right.
do. It's just she didn't interact at all with the contemporary philosophy going on around her.
Right.
She spent most of her time debating dead men, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to read you know, Ayn Rand's works, you would have no idea that there was this whole debate going on about logical positivism. It's just not even present. It's like she's not even aware of it, not even interacting with it.
And it's the kind of thing that she... It would have been interesting to see her sink her teeth into.
She
too.
Should have, yes. I think so. But in many ways, Ayn Rand was more a polemicist than a
right.
philosopher. But nevertheless, she did do philosophy, I think,
right.
and did it at least in spirit the way philosophy should be taken. That's the sort of
right.
thing real philosophers should be doing.
A philosophy that's meant to be relevant and useful and
relevant,
informing.
Useful, and coherent and comprehensive. I mean,
right.
the whole world view has to cohere together, and you need to pay attention to all those aspects of
mm-hmm.
it. And the issue of plain language versus jargonizing and all of that. I mean, the way she was doing philosophy is the way philosophy should be done,
yeah,
apart
yeah.
from the fact that she was ignoring everybody
right.
else
and,
around
and the,
her.
and the plain language aspect is one of the reasons that she is still really widely read and loved, even by people
oh, absolutely.
Who, if you get them talking, they actually don't believe a thing she says. But they read her, and they're like, yes, exactly, that's what I've been meaning.
Yes, yeah, that's
but,
so
but,
true.
But if you take it out of context and you talk about that idea with them, they're like, oh, no, you're kidding? No, that's,
yeah.
you know.
Well, this, you could say the same of Foucault, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same way. I mean, he's a really good writer. People read him, but,
mm-hmm.
You know, when it comes right down to it, in actual practice, they aren't enacting it, half the things that
right.
he said. Although, to be honest, a lot of postmodernists themselves, what they are saying is not, in fact, what Foucault said.
No, and Foucault is gone. Before he died, if I remember, he went a little nuts with what had been done with his work.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I've seen postmodernists spout lots of things, And so I would go and read an actual postmodernist work that they were citing, and I go, well, wait a minute, this author is not saying at all what you are saying. But
yep.
that's a problem, and true. But I think that problem is everywhere.
Yeah,
that's
I think that's a human nature problem.
Well, yeah,
you
look at the way Christians treat the
right,
Bible,
yeah,
it's the same way.
Exactly
it's like, wait a minute, the Bible doesn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, so those are all that we've just surveyed, all the ways that I think I differ from many other metaphysical naturalists. But in that sense, I'm not you know, I'm not a lone wolf in that sense. There are metaphysical naturalists who side with me mm-hmm. on some or all of these issues.
But your main interest that distinguishes you from them is in the coherency and the nuance and attempting to make it mean something rather than just be specialized musings yes. on particular topics.
Yes, I would say that, yes, I think I want to see more people who believe in metaphysical naturalism as a worldview mm-hmm. start articulating it as a worldview rather than just basing it on certain sort of isolated assumptions and then just picking on a particular field and focusing on right. that. I don't think that's useful because I think you're going to make a lot of mistakes when you're working in a particular field like ethics. If you're not constantly referring to how that coheres with all the other aspects of your mm-hmm. worldview, I think you're inevitably going to make mistakes, and that's a problem. Mm-hmm. There's a defense of Kantian philosophy that just came out recently from a metaphysical naturalist perspective, and it's Let's very see. Popular now. It's Value and Virtue in a Godless Universe by Eric Weilenberg. He defends Kantian philosophy, or Kantian mm-hmm. ethics. He's right about a lot of things, but he's ultimately, his system of ethics has absolutely no foundation. I mean, when you start to really criticize, well, why should I be moral? His book doesn't really provide a really coherent or intelligible answer. And I mm-hmm. think the reason he fails at that, and the reason Kant failed, is that they didn't pay attention to how the whole system coheres with your metaphysics and with your epistemology right. and so on. I have other things to say about Kant in my book. But yeah, that's an example of where specializing and saying, I'm going to defend Kantian ethics from a point of view of naturalism, is basically spinning wheels, because you're writing a lot of great stuff that mm-hmm. ultimately falls apart
because you can't make it relate to anything else.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think it comes down to that basic question of why should I believe anything you say? Why should I mm-hmm. have these virtues? Why should I be virtuous? He tries to provide an answer, but it's not an entirely coherent or a persuasive answer. Mm-hmm. And that really sort of undermines the whole project. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can't answer that basic question, then everything else you say about ethics is pretty much a waste of time, except insofar as you're criticizing other ethical views. So that, to me, is an example of a naturalist doing it the wrong way, and where I think we'd be better off if naturalists were doing what I was doing, writing books that try to present an entire coherent system. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see more philosophers doing that. The only philosopher I know who's alive today who's done anything like it is Mario Bunga. He wrote basically an 8-volume treatise that's a complete metaphysical naturalist worldview.
Wow.
Hyper-technical, jargonized, symbolic logic throughout. He did that on purpose because he wrote the 8 volumes for an academic
right.
community. I don't even think they're in print anymore, but you can find them in libraries. He's written more popularizing stuff where he uses plain language and so forth, which is also what I think philosophers should do. But he's the only one who's actually at least attempted to create a complete worldview, naturalist right. worldview, and present it out there. Of course, hardly anyone has heard of it. So that, you know, but I think more naturalists should be doing this.
Cool. And you keep coming back to the question of epistemology. How does your epistemology differ from what apologists are using, the Reformed epistemology, and how do both of them differ from classical foundationalism?
Yeah, I've got. I have 3 chapters in the book, The Empty Tomb, Jesus Beyond the Grave, which is about the resurrection of Jesus, of course, which is not necessarily an epistemology, but there is a chapter in there by Evan Fales called Reformed Epistemology and Biblical Hermeneutics. That, I would say, is a good introduction to what the Reformed epistemologists now are trying to argue and what's wrong with it, in a sense. And I also, speaking of specifically, I don't use the term Reformed epistemology mm-hmm. or anything, but in my book, if you even look at Planting in the Index, you'll see I have several sections where I criticize his view, especially in my section on Warrant. I have a whole section on Warrant.
For our listeners who might not be familiar with it, what is Warrant?
To just put it in colloquial terms, I mean, if belief in something is warranted...
Okay.
So what has to be the case for you to be warranted in saying that something mm-hmm. is true, in a sense, which is sounds like, well, isn't that like very circuitous? But it is very important because mm-hmm. there's the whole idea
it's
of justification
your
of knowledge.
Standard of truth.
In a sense, but it's actually more proved? Fundamental than that.
Really? Okay.
I mean, your standard of truth are the sorts of what sorts of things would convince you. But the deeper analysis is, why do those things convince you? Why mm-hmm. should they convince you? And that's the basis of warrant, in okay. a sense. When are we warranted in believing? And so the Reformed epistemologist, well, Plantinga, for example, he puts it that if Christian theism is true in some basic sense, then it follows that God would surely instill in us an innate ability to directly perceive the fundamental truths of the Christian gospel. Which, as a proposition, you know, is internally coherent. Yes, right. Sure. If Christian theism was true, God would do that. That certainly makes sense to me. And then from that, he extrapolates through some legerdemain the view that a Christian, therefore, can be warranted in believing all the fundamental aspects of the gospel without requiring any evidence for it, because if it's true, God would have instilled in them the direct awareness that it is true, in the sense that, you know, if you're looking at something and you see it's the color is red, you might be able to debate whether there's a red object there, but the fact that you're seeing red is undeniable.
You can't deny, right.
Exactly. So what he's saying is that the basic truths of the gospel are like that experience.
Kind of a physical axiom.
In a sense, yes.
Wow.
That you can start from the assumption that Christian theism is true. And that's why he focuses so much on, I don't know if you're aware of the evolutionary argument against naturalism.
C.S. Lewis was the first one to formulate that.
Yes, but Plantinga needs it because he has to undermine naturalism at a fundamental level in order to justify the recourse to a Christian saying...
Yeah, now I've never found that argument at all persuasive.
No, and yeah.
You know, if an organism evolves in an environment and it survives, it will have survived because it evolved the proper tools to perceive the environment correctly.
Yeah, there are certain correct arguments against what you just said. However, those arguments don't lead to Plantinga's conclusion. And I deal with this issue somewhat in my book. I think I have a section in there on the justification of reason. I have a whole chapter on reason. What is the nature of reason? And I have a section there where I hugely criticize the sort of absurd arguments that Plantinga has made. But you're right. The evolutionary argument against naturalism is fallacious in many respects. But he needs it because if naturalism is not a viable option, then it becomes a viable option to say, well, if I feel that the gospel is true, then the reason I feel the gospel is true may be because God instilled in me this fundamental perception that the gospel is true, and therefore Christian theism is true.
The problem with that is that it's not exclusive to Christian theism.
Plantinga has made the sort of presented the position that, well, yes, if you're not a Christian, you might be able to make the same argument, but I'm a Christian, so, you know, I can only argue from the position that I'm in, and so other Christians can do so as well.
God, does he know how vacuous that is?
Yes, exactly. And so, and therefore, of course, the legions that take this ridiculous philosophy and then go out and try to convert people take it from the position that, well, if you can get people to open their mind and feel the gospel's truths, then what we're doing is we're activating their what they call a sensus divinitatis, where they're finally realizing the truth in a sense, and so it becomes more a very epistemology of what you feel is true is true. That's not what they would say. They would abhor the thought that I would even suggest that that's what they're saying.
But
in reality, that's what it amounts to. Yes, exactly. It's the whole what I call a Holy Spirit epistemology.
Right.
William Lane Craig has made the same argument in his book Reasonable Faith. He says, you know, regardless of all, if all the evidence contradicts Christian theism, but you have faith, if you feel that from the you feel the Holy Spirit telling you that Christian theism is true, that therefore the evidence must be wrong.
Now there's actually,
and that's an example of Reformed epistemology.
There's actually a good question in that, though, and this will take us right into what your epistemology is. But the line between the experiential data of the senses, which is the ultimate basis for classical foundationalism,
right,
and your particular naturalist epistemology, from a classical foundationalist position, you can argue, I don't think successfully, but at least well, that direct religious experience is a valid basis for a worldview.
I see what you're saying.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I do take this up. I have a chapter in my book on spirituality, which I take material from an article I had published earlier in Critical Inquiry on why that doesn't work. And in particular, it was in response to a Buddhist making that argument. Which is different because normally you hear it from the Christian perspective, but showing how it's wrong for a Buddhist, you can extrapolate easily how it's wrong for Christians or Muslims or whatever. There are a number of flaws with it, and I bring them out in there, but to speak in terms of classical foundationalism, if you want to see where my form of foundationalism that I take, I mean, I abhor labels, so I don't embrace any label whatsoever. But if you go online, I have a critique of Michael Rhee's book World Without Design, which in turn was a critique of naturalism. I critique that, and he takes a lot of this idea of Plantinga's arguments from Warrant as contrary to foundationalism and so forth. And I start from an actual foundationalist perspective and show how Rhee's got the starting point wrong. And there I describe what I think is the foundation of all knowledge. And I, well, for example, what where Plantinga differs from foundationalists is what he regards as acceptably properly basic knowledge, which is properly basic means something that you can believe without having to justify it.
Right. So Descartes was, I think, therefore I am.
Exactly.
And then he was, I cannot doubt that I doubt.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Things like that. But even more broadly, what feelings or experiences can you take as basic? Now, my position is that in the properly basic sense, in a sense of something that you literally don't have to offer evidence to defend, I think the only beliefs that can be considered properly basic are beliefs that literally cannot be denied. So that's the most fundamental thing. I am seeing a patch of red now. I mean, that's undeniable. It's there's no,
as opposed to there is red there, which could be deniable.
Exactly.
Depending on
exactly.
Brain
and I think
anomalies. And
right.
Perceptive
and so in a philosophical sense, epistemologically, you're starting from the basis of undeniable propositions, right. You know, the undeniable facts of our experience, which would include feelings and thoughts and right. The feeling of the Holy Spirit right. And all that.
And
stuff.
And how do you? But then you have to bridge the gap from the brain in a jar. Epistemology
exactly.
Out.
Right. So how do you get from I'm feeling or experiencing this to there's an actual thing that's causing this?
Right.
And that's where, and of course, also properly basic are the thoughts and so forth that are involved. And so when you construct models, the fact that those models are being constructed in your head is also properly basic. And so then it's a question of fitting the models to the data. What model actually explains the data mm-hmm. better? Of course, this is how scientific method
right.
works. This is my epistemology, and I think so. Everything that we say that goes beyond the undeniable are hypotheses about why these undeniable experiences are happening. Mm-hmm. And so I think all knowledge in that form, all the warranted beliefs that we have, are based on models that explain why we're experiencing these things, that are the best explanation of why we're experiencing mm-hmm. these things. And that's when you get to, yes, it is properly basic that you feel something like a Holy Spirit telling you something. But then again, it's also properly basic that you see water on the horizon. But the water on the horizon might be a mirage. It might be, you know, deflection of photons by rising hot air.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, well, what actually is out there on the horizon? Is it water or is it just rising hot air? And so that you fit the model to the facts. And so when you start doing that, then you start to see this problem, like you were pointing out, where all these different religions are also feeling their own spirits telling them
right.
things.
It's basically a philosophical formulation of the scientific fact-checking.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And this is where I think the biggest refutation of Plantinga's view is that, yes, it's absolutely true that if Christian theism was true, God would have instilled in all of us a fundamental direct perception mm-hmm. of the truths of the gospel. But had he done that, we would all have
be
a fundamental
Christians.
I mean, from
right.
from day one, there would not be a culture that did not have the gospel in it.
Right.
You know, everybody would feel an experience. You might have some people that deviate from it, but there'd be no doubt that everybody is feeling and experiencing the same thing, and it would go
right.
all the way back to, you know, the dawn of man, essentially. So
right. And
you know, you would have you would go find these isolated Siberian tribes out that have never communicated with civilization at
mm-hmm.
all, and you'd run into them, and they would be telling you, yes, we had these guys preaching the gospel here, even, you know, from as far back as we can remember. Everybody would have that experience. The fact that we don't, the fact mm-hmm. that there's no, and in fact it's even culturally and geographically constrained as to
mm-hmm.
who's actually feeling the Holy Spirit telling
right.
them these things, is proof positive that God has not instilled this direct perception
mm-hmm.
in us. And if it's true that if Christian theism is true that God would do this, then Christian theism is therefore false.
Right.
So
not to mention the basic epistemological problem of positing an ambiguous result as definitive proof of a particular cause.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are many other areas where you could criticize the thesis. But that is, and so I am a foundationalist in sort of the absolute sense that
mm-hmm.
I think that everything is founded on undeniable experiences, but then I include in the undeniable experiences the hypotheses themselves, and then it's probabilistic after that, because
gotcha,
you know, which
okay.
hypotheses you should believe is based
mm-hmm.
on probabilistic arguments based
right.
on the undeniables.
So you depend a lot more on the inference to the best explanation than...
Totally, yes.
Well, that's all we have time for this week with Richard Carrier, but we'll be back next week with the balance of our interview. Those of you in the Bay Area, be sure to catch Richard Carrier's panel appearance at the West Coast Atheist Regional Meet in Foster City, California on June 24th. He'll be joining a panel talking about some of the strange and funny things that have been claimed about Jesus. The information for that event is available at www.eastbayatheists.org. Until next week, I'm Dan the Demented. Next week will be joining me again Richard Carrier and Deviant Deb, saying, get your mind out of the sewer, I want to be alone.